Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everybody. This is Danny Nesvetterani, your host for this hour of Speak Up on Tuesday, October 14th, 2025. Before I get started with this hour, I just want to acknowledge that this broadcast, this show, all of our programs here at CJSF broadcast on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkamilam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here since time immemorial. And to start off today's episode, I'm going to be playing some local music because I think that's a good way to start off this week. I know it's Tuesday, but yesterday was a holiday, so I think this is the beginning of a week for a lot of people. And this track is from Mary Anchetta with Comortal, and it is titled Minikawa. Hope you enjoy.
Protected all through the rubble, you step to me, start seeing double. My team around me, ancestral bubble. I've come in peace, a shield encircles the sound of drums. A phoenix flying to the sun, under its wings I'm hidden from. Spirits swept by rage, get out of my way. Spirits misaligned, find another timeline. Planets retrograde, the motion of space, collective quake, giants awake. Trust in my way, navigate me safe. Thank you.
Once again, that was Mary Anchetta and Kimmortal with Minokawa. And we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM to start off this hour of talk. Here's an interview that I did very recently with Doug Kellum, a Canada Post worker, as well as a member of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, who was on the picket line last week in East Vancouver. Since this interview, the format of the strike has changed. It is now a rotating strike, so there is limited services happening within Canada Post. But I think a lot of what he says within this interview is still quite relevant, and I think sheds a light on the perspective of the people on the picket lines. I think a lot of the coverage when you look into the Canada Post strike is how it is affecting local businesses and things of that nature, which absolutely is something that should be covered. But I think it's also important to learn their perspective of the people that are on the picket line itself. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Doug Kellum.
And our station itself just went through a restructure, and now with the minister's announcement, they want to restructure further to the point where they're going to eliminate thousands and thousands of jobs. And to us, that's an existential attack on our jobs, and it's an existential attack on the service that we provide to the public. And Canada Post management, senior management, looks at the operation as if it's a business that must generate a profit. And we look at it as something more than that. We look at it as a public service and a piece of important infrastructure that ties the country together, that ties communities together, and they can move products from St. John's, Newfoundland, all the way to Vancouver at a rate that could beat most of the major carriers that are out there, if not all of them, in terms of parcel rates. What else can I say about that? Well, and if they want to talk about businesses, well, the fact is that our chief executive officer, Doug Ettinger, sits on the board of a company that's directly in competition with Canada Post called Purolator, which I'm sure you've heard of. And Canada Post owns 90% of Purolator. So effectively, what we have is a competition between two branches of the same corporation. And we think of that from our end as a huge conflict of interest. And we also see that as an attempt to undermine the parts of Canada Post that could be making a profit in parcel delivery, with the objective probably of privatizing that part of us, the parts of us that are profitable still, right? So that's about it on that question.
I guess another thing I was curious about is what do you think is something about the current demands of the union that the general public isn't as aware of, you know, aside from things such as wages?
Well, a lot of the public, I think, still thinks of us as being somehow subsidized by taxpayer dollars, and that is not the case and has not been the case through the vast majority of Canada Post's existence. In fact, for decades and decades, Canada Post brought in huge profits, which effectively made it the government's piggy bank. And as, again, people know, we worked all the way through COVID and helped keep our economy going and the country going during that really dark time. We didn't take wage increases then, and now, you know, we're getting more or less kicked in the teeth for that, for making that decision when we could have gone on strike, when we could have pushed for better wages, whatnot. What else do people not know about Canada Post? I don't know. We're probably the most important mover of parcels for the final mile, as they call it, which is to say, outside of the urban centers, a lot of the big carriers aren't even operating. In fact, what they do is they stream their product to us, and so we deliver to all the little towns out there. And again, that's another reason why we're finding ourselves at a point where we can't actually make profits now. It's because there's huge competition in the urban markets, where the money is, the majority of the money is, and the labor standards are extremely low. Like, a lot of this is being done by gig work, or gig workers, people basically delivering out of the backs of their own cars, right? You know, they don't have health care, they don't have benefits. Right, these are jobs that are going to, you know, new Canadians, they're going to people that are in precarious situations, right? Big corporations like Google and UPS, they can rely on these small carriers, right? And they can use that model. We can't use that model, right? And in addition, they don't have to serve those small communities, right? We do have to serve those small communities. So we want the government to think of us as a service. We want the people that we serve to think of us as a service, and we want people to understand that what is happening is an attack on that service, right? And then it's an attempt, another neoliberal attempt to basically slash at public service, privatize the profitable parts that they can then sell to friends of the government, i.e., like Melanie Jolie's brother, who is a huge stakeholder in a basically a parcel delivery service called Intelcom, that's international, and that originally received money from Canada Post to help start it up, right? So, yeah, and Melanie Jolie she's a liberal, right? You know, so it's classic. We think it's classic cronyism. And, I mean, we know historically the Liberals have always cut inside deals, as well as the Conservatives, right? I'm not tarring one, saying one's better than the other. They're all facets of the same ruling class, and they're all the same, they all go to the same clubs. They might have different rhetoric, but at the end of the day, yeah, they're promoting a business-first ideology. And we just don't think that that's appropriate for Canada. We don't think it's appropriate for a country like ours that's enormous and where people actually need those supports still. We need that infrastructure, right? So, yeah. And the other aspect then, of course, is like, you know, there's always money for guns, right? You know, as you probably know, Carney has announced that Canada will be contributing 5% of its gross domestic product towards rearmament and expanding the Canadian military. This is money we will never see back, right? You know, they don't ask the military to make a profit, though militaries do make a profit by, you know, I mean, participating in imperialist wars, such as we're doing in the Ukraine and Gaza, right? So, you know, this is, again, it's about priorities, and it's about the way these systems operate and how they affect the services that people need to actually live decent lives, right? And things that actually are productive and that benefit all Canadians and helps Canadian small businesses. And, yeah. Do all of those things.
I mean, I guess from your perspective, what changes need to happen for the government as well as just the larger public to consider and to view and for Canada Post to function as a service rather than something that needs to generate a profit?
Well, short of a socialist revolution that obliterates the capitalist ruling class and takes the means of production into the hands of the people that actually do the work, what could we do? Well, we've offered a number of options, such as postal banking, that would help support to support our service, right? And it would also provide needed services throughout Canada, and once again in communities that are underserved at present with things like banking services. A lot of our workforce would actually like to see would like to see our corporation be worker owned and operated effectively, right? And get rid of management and deal directly with the government, because at the end of the day, they placed management in between themselves and the actual service. Government has placed management in between itself and the service, and I think it's been exposed, the actual relationship between the service and the workers, right? That it's actually government that's calling the shots here, right? Management is just implementing the sorts of plans that government wants. So I think involving the workers directly in the operations of the corporation in a democratic way, involving the communities that we serve in a democratic way, all right, and expanding into areas where we need services, where we have the infrastructure, the existing infrastructure to bring services to communities throughout the country. So a much more democratic and inclusive public service, that's one way we could do it, right? Yeah.
I think the only question I'd have left for you is, where do you foresee this going? Has there been any progress in terms of negotiations? I know there was an offer made that was a step back from what was originally made earlier. So has there been any progress on that?
We characterize the offer that they tried to make us vote on, that they did make us vote on, which we rejected by almost a 70% margin, as basically a dog turd with whipped cream on top of it. Well, the latest offer is a dog turd without any whipped cream. The whipped cream was the $1,000 bonus that they've taken away this round. They've also taken away job protections, and they're floating the idea of buyouts and ultimately talking about layoffs, right? There has been very little progress from there, right? I don't think we can see. All right, right on. Solidarity. It's nice to get a beep on the picket line. There's no progress right now. We're in a deadlock, and we could use the support of the labor movement, and not just verbal support. We get that anytime, any place. But we need to have workers coming out and joining our picket lines, and we need to have the community coming out, joining our picket lines, going after their MPs, going after their political representatives, because it really is about saving. It isn't just about us and our jobs. It's about the whole service and what the Canadians want. And Carney was not elected with a mandate of gutting Canada Post, right? And if anything, I think most Canadians thought they were voting for somebody who that would help, that would preserve Canadian jobs, that would preserve Canadian services. And what we're getting instead is a toady for, you know, the imperialist business class. So we need to fight this, and we need to fight it collectively, and it's going to take more than just Canada, you know, the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. It's going to take all of the unions that are going to be threatened by Carney's austerity plans, by Carney's expansion of the military plans, by this, you know, by this iteration of neoliberalism.
Once again, that was Doug Kellum, a employee with Canada Post and member of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, on the picket line last week during this ongoing Canada Post strike. So, coming up next on this hour of Speak Up, we have another piece that is within BC, but a little farther. This one's on the island. No, not on the island. Scratch that. This one is more up north. This is in Hazelton, BC. And it is about a local bioremediation group that is working to find a climate-forward solution to dealing with wood waste. This piece comes from Pamela Hassan from CICK in Smithers, BC. Take a listen.
This is CICK News. I drove to Sikadak on Thursday last week to meet Anissa Watson at a community garden. The community of Sikidak is well on its way to becoming food sovereign by raising their own chickens and pigs. They have a food-safe kitchen in the community center, massive gardens for growing seasonal veggies and fruit trees, as well as a recently built greenhouse for off-season growing. We met at the back edge of a farm close to a treed area where we stood in front of 10 piles of wood chips. Within these wood chips were mycelium with the power to change how we in the north manage wood waste. These mycelium have undergone rigorous training to learn to eat these wood chips with the goal for them to eat eventually bad wood, such as creosote-soaked rail ties and slash piles, to minimize burning or waste wood entering our precious river system. Here's Anissa Now from Sikidak. Where are we?
So we're in the community of Sikidak. This is a Gitxsan community, probably about 15 kilometers out of Hazleton, BC. We are going down into an area where they're just working to develop some food security sites. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at here in front of us, even though it looks just like a pile of wood chips, is a field testing site for a project called Coldfire.
That's Anissa Watson, the Director of Program Execution for Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition. A local innovation project called Coldfire is using mushrooms to tackle wildfire risks and waste wood management. Partnering through the Fire Grand Challenge, the team is testing how fungi can speed up the natural decay of wood waste, turning it into compost that stores carbon, keeping nutrients in the soil, and promoting healthy regeneration. 10 piles have been created as part of this science-based field trial in the community of Sikidak.
What we did in the early summer is we had our technical partner, Coalitions and Collaboratives, come up from Colorado. Those mushrooms were cultivated off of trees, so wild cultivation. So these mushrooms were trained to eat this specific wood in the lab, and then they were grown. So their next generations of DNA were basically like trained specifically to eat this wood here. So we started off with four different types of mushrooms and then chose the best quality one from the lab experiments to inoculate the piles with.
All summer, the Coldfire team has been hard at work gathering and chipping waste wood for their mushroom-based wildfire prevention project. 3 weeks ago, they inoculated the piles with moist mushroom spawn blocks supplied by Smithereens Mushrooms. Each pile has 9 inoculation points, and already the piles have dropped nearly 2 feet as the fungi get to work breaking down this wood. The team's been back in the field collecting data, measuring pile size, moisture levels, and carbon content to track how well the mushrooms are transforming waste wood into rich, healthy soil, which is where Anissa and I met to have this discussion.
Last week, we harvested a bunch of mushrooms. It looks like I think some other folks were harvesting mushrooms off of here, which is exactly the point.
Yeah.
So we've been getting oyster mushrooms off of all these piles. And what we're looking at is just like, how quick is this happening? How much moisture are they holding? And then in about 3 years, we're expecting these piles to be basically broken down into a woody compost material for the ground here. Yeah. The unique thing about Sikidak is that they are a community that's expanding and really pushing food security and food sovereignty.
The Coldfire team sourced much of their waste wood from a new greenhouse site that had to be cleared, chipping the material on location. Right beside it sits a thriving community forest with apple, plum, and cherry trees, and a perfect example of how local waste wood management can support regeneration. The key is having a system in place. When crews clear and chip at the same time, the process runs smoothly. Their long-term goal is to see this mushroom-based wood recycling approach used in logging cut blocks across the region.
Our main concern was around wildfire mitigation and the impact of clear-cut logging on both soil and then what's happening with the waste wood, which is often just getting either left or burned. Either way, it becomes a fire hazard and all the carbon that's being released and the emissions into the atmosphere. And so we want to be able to offer a viable solution to loggers or to forestry to say, hey, chip it. Leave it on the ground. As soon as wood is chipped, even if there's no fungal inoculation, it becomes a like way less of a risk for wildfire. So it reduces that wildfire risk almost immediately.
Why?
Because when it's chipped, it holds moisture. As these piles were chipped, if it gets a rain or whatever, it'll hold moisture. These piles will stay moist. Like you can dig your hand down into them, even in a hot spell. And then they're also helping the soil to recover. In this area, like, that's pretty healthy soil. It wasn't a clear cut, but when that happens out on the territory or out on the Lac Yip or in the forest, what we're finding is when you go in and you clear cut, you're also exposing a ton of soil to the sun, to the elements, to the rain. So you're really degrading the soil ecology, and this process builds soil ecology. So that's also what we're looking at.
And that's because you want more nitrogen? Like, you were talking about the nitrogen carbon?
Yeah. So this is a way cold fire stores carbon in a stable state in the soil. So what we're looking at is, like, what is the ratio of the carbon to nitrogen ratio that comes from cold fire, just so that we understand, like, how it could be, like, is there the possibility of using the compost at the end of it as, like, a byproduct that could be sold? And then we also just want to know, like, how much carbon is being stored. We do know that none is being released into the atmosphere. So, yeah, it's basically we're doing the exact same thing that fire does, but without burning.
And so in this phase here, when you've got the chips, these are chips from healthy trees, but the goal is for, like, treated wood, or we were talking about, like, rail, like, creosote-soaked rail ties and things like that.
Yeah.
So what process do you start introducing those sort of maybe more, like, toxic or wood that would take more work?
Yeah, so that would be, I think, a different process. The nice thing about this is that this is healthy wood, so it can be left in the field. When we're talking about mycomitigation for things like creosote or toxins, you would approach field testing much differently.
Mycomitigation is quite simply the use of fungi to break down pollutants. Here's a video from Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition's Instagram, read by Shantae Mitchell, explaining that process further.
These fungi release enzymes that break down tough plant fibers, speeding up the decay, turning that debris into fire-resistant, nutrient-rich compost. The compost feeds new growth and acts like a sponge, holding moisture, supporting biodiversity, and making forests more resilient to future fires. And instead of slash burning, which can contribute as much as 12% of British Columbia's greenhouse gas emissions, we're choosing a different path. By using cold fire, we sequester that carbon into the ground as nutrients rather than releasing it as emissions. It's about sharing natural, regenerative techniques that anyone can use to care for the land. This isn't about selling a product. It's about working with nature, not against it. And now we're bringing it to our forest with hope, care, and collaboration. We're not here to control the forest. We're here to work with it, to listen, to heal, and protect what protects us.
So it's always do no harm. Any sort of mycomitigation or bioremediation approaches where you're supporting the land to heal itself, the human aspect is do no harm. When it comes to things like creosote or treated wood, you're dealing with some different types of materials. So say, for example, with creosote, where you have that, like, oily kind of polycyclic hydrocarbon sort of stuff in there, you have to be very careful about containing it. So this type of site wouldn't work for that. You would look at doing it in more of a contained vessel. So it's the mycelium that are doing the work for us, and the fruiting bodies are sort of that extra bonus that we see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bonuses, I like those.
Yeah.
This bioremediation team's next project takes on something tougher: creosote treated rail ties. Working with bioremediation specialist Lila Darwish, they trained mushrooms in the lab to break down small pieces of the toxic wood. The star performer? Turkey tail mushrooms, known for digesting oils and pollutants. The next step is to grow those lab specimens into full mushroom spawn for field testing.
So that basically those mushrooms, as they get larger and ready to, like, fruit, they're constantly having more access to creosote as their food source. Mm-hmm. Here in this, like, field testing with the cold fire, I ate mushrooms off of here last week.
Okay.
So this is healthy and safe. With creosote, we wouldn't eat those mushrooms, right? Yeah. You're still dealing with toxins a lot of times, so you have to be careful of yourself, of the land, of anything that might come in contact with it, wildlife, birds, whatever, and being really aware that you're not increasing the risk of toxins to get spread, that you're really containing them and dealing with them. So it's not always a perfect solution. We're still, I think in 2026, we'll be able to do a bit more work on the creosote. We were very focused on this year. So we're really interested in, yeah, figuring out then the best inoculation method for mushrooms and mycelium into a creosote tie.
Along the Upper Skeena, old rail ties have been pushed into nearby ditches, some right above local streams, so that when it rains, runoff passes through those creosote-soaked ties and into the water.